And feel free to drop it. Those are sturdy pieces of technology.
All right. And it cannot rub on anything, right?
All it looks good. I'll do one of these in case I need to recover and synchronize, which shouldn't happen, but has happened in the past. All right. And I'll just press and we just go and we just get into it. And you know the drill. You've listened to every single one of those, which makes you, I think, the only individual alive right now in the world that you have a claim to fame. The one person who listened to every single episode. I don't think there's anyone else. I myself haven't listened to every single one. I doubt Pablo has.
Yeah, I know you're very modest and the proverbial five listeners that you mentioned.
It's a thing. It's not 500, I can tell you that. It's a small crowd. It's a small crowd. But I consider all of them important people. So tell me about that. How did you end up finding No Solutions? How did you end up finding out about Sovereign Engineering? What brings you here? You're a first-time participant. We're in SCCO 8th cohort. And I want to just pick your brain about all of this. Like, how come you're here? How did you discover this crazy niche world, this corner of the internet?
Yeah, I think it's a series of breadcrumbs where each transition was a gate with a relatively low probability of passing through.
So but, what was the first one? Was Bitcoin before that?
Yeah, so Bitcoin was definitely before that, and I have heard of Noster a few years back, but never explored it because it was initially framed to me as this, okay, decentralized social network. I have kind of an uneasy relationship and a history with social networks. So I kind of dismissed it out of hand. Okay, whatever.
How come? What were your social networks of choice, if any? And how come you have an uneasy relationship?
Yeah, it's a...
Are you a terrorist and you were deplatformed all the time?
I was deplatformed by Instagram, of all places.
Okay.
And I had... and it's an interesting story. Not that I was censored, but my handle was rugged.
Hmm.
So it's kind of, I think an unusual story. But I had
a short one, probably.
Without kind of...
without doxing yourself too hard.
Reducing the anonymity too much. I had a very valuable Instagram handle.
Mm-hmm.
As valuable as they get.
Mm-hmm.
And because I was a super early user.
Yeah.
I literally registered my account, I think maybe within an hour or so of them announcing that they're live on TechCrunch.
Okay, wow.
So I had a good handle. And about 10 years of history of posting,
yeah,
mostly travel photography and so on. So quite an investment. And I knew...
You're not the only person that happened to... That ran into this issue. There are some other people that had like very valuable accounts and the platform just decided to grab it.
Yeah, so it was a clearly an inside job.
Yeah.
Because I knew I had something valuable. So my OPSEC was top notch. It was unguessable password of ridiculous length.
Yeah.
2FA.
Yeah.
My email, you know, was also similarly protected. There was just post factum, I did a security audit. Nothing else was compromised.
Yeah.
It was quite clear that it was just rugged. You know, it was an inside job.
You got an official statement from anyone or no?
No, but there was an article in Wall Street Journal a few months later, which I think it was titled Meta Employees and Security Guards Fired for Hijacking User Accounts.
Oh, okay.
So that came out eventually. And it's interesting. I tried to actually recover my account because, you know, you really, I mean, it's a massive entity, so you're unable to go through regular channels because there's no person to talk to.
Yeah.
But you know, I used to live in Bay Area, you know, in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
So I have my network there, so I was able to go out of band actually.
Yeah.
And talk to some people inside Facebook.
Yeah.
That were quite close, and they were actually even able to kind of try to do a few things out of band to restore my account, to give me access to the account. It was quite clear that it was just, there was something going on internally where I just,
I see,
I could not regain access to my account. So
someone higher up the food chain wanted to have your account.
I don't know. I kind of, I gave up on it and soured on the whole idea. And, but in general, this kind of planted the seed. Okay, this is, you really don't own this.
Yes.
And I knew this for a while because I had something valuable, but I was very well aware that I really cannot, like, make any claim. You know, I did not hold the keys.
You have no power. Like, you can also, you know, go the legal route and all those kind of things, but you won't have a leeway because there's so much fine print. You don't own anything there. It's it's their house. They can kick you out at any time for any reason. They can do whatever. And so, yeah, that was one part of your radicalization.
Yeah. That was one pillar for sure. And then, yeah, like I said, I dismissed Noster initially, and it was not until I decided to quit my fiat job due to, you could say, like a crisis of purpose. I had quite a cushy... Oh,
that makes two of us.
Yeah, okay. Quite a cushy job where I was writing a sizable team, you know, a data team, maybe like 20 plus people across kind of multiple layers of the stack. And I really couldn't continue doing this any longer. And I wanted to do something in Bitcoin specifically. Mm-hmm. So I spent a few months just going through the layers of the Bitcoin stack, top to bottom, looking for something that at the intersection of what I would be interested in and kind of the things that I understood well, you know, my capabilities. And I spent months and months actually on this and filled a lot of gaps in my knowledge for sure. But in the end, I was like, fuck man, this is like so mature actually. There's so much that has been done.
And, so when you're talking about data science and big data on Bitcoin, you're talking about stuff like Glassnode and analysis of block data and those kind of things potentially.
Yeah, I was not even looking to do any kind of analysis, but I mean, before I was a data engineer guy and a data analyst, I was a software guy for like 20 years.
Okay.
So systems, anything. So I was just looking for something to do. And I was getting quite desperate. After a few months, I just, I thought maybe I would do, I recognize this tunnel from the old other episodes.
Yeah, it's a free audio effect.
Yes, I love it. I love it. I knew it the instant that we were inside. So I was getting like quite desperate. And at some point I was like, okay, I'm forcing it too hard. So fuck it, let me just play around a little bit and do whatever just for fun.
Yeah.
And the thing that I picked up for fun was one of those so-called Lotto miners. Mm. It's literally an ESP32 board with a screen.
Was it before BitX or was
before.
It?
Before.
Yeah.
That was the precursor.
Yeah.
So I picked one of those up and I was like quite captivated by the fact that it's, you know, here it is, a super low-powered piece of compute that is actually contributing hash power to the network.
Yeah.
As minuscule as it is.
Yeah.
You know, it's doing its work hashing. So I started tinkering with NerdMiner, is the open source piece of software that was running on the ESP32 device. And this was also around the time where it became practical to actually do some vibe coding and so on. Because my background is kind of computer science and mathematics, actually, of all things, not electrical engineering. So I was a total noob. It was a gap on the hardware side. So I was like, finally, this kind of, with LLMs and coding agents, this became accessible. So I was able to just start hacking on NerdMiner and start modifying the software. So quite fascinating. And then, of course, at some point it occurs to me, all right, so I'm fucking around with this like low hash rate.
Yeah.
Let me get the real thing with a real ASIC in it.
All
see
right.
what I can do there.
All right. So you get hooked.
Yeah. So
got an S9 or something.
No, not that far, but still solo mining. But Bitax and the things that OSMU guys are doing.
Yeah.
So, and lo and behold, it actually turns out that Bitax is also based on ESP32.
Yeah.
So it's a very versatile platform. I mean, surprise, surprise. Things are just good abstractions and good platforms. They just layer. So amazing. So I start looking into this. Start doing a bunch of things like overclocking them, building tooling for noise monitoring. For example, I'm quite sensitive to noise overall. It was bothering me that I had, at that point, like maybe four of these solo miners. I had a BitX and three QX++. At some point, I was like running something like 20 tera hash and they were overclocked.
Nice.
So it was quite loud. I was like, okay, let me try to actually tune these guys. But
and that was at home, basically.
At home.
So noise is an issue with sleeping and everything.
In a separate bedroom, but still, I could hear it from like the opposite end of the flat. So I tried to build software and actually a complementary hardware rig where I would have a noise sensor picking up on decibel levels, and I would be able to tune
just the flow, like a thermometer, basically,
not just
but for
the
noise
hash rate, but also for the decibels that were acceptable. So through that, I had a few fans fail on these Bitaxes, because of course I was abusing them, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So a couple of fans failed, and overall, okay, noise failure rates and so on. I was like, man, there's got to be a better way. I care less about, you know, after a while, you realize that you care maybe less about the hash rate rather than that you are hashing and it's low maintenance.
You're co-living with your miners and you care more about the co-living aspect than the brute hash rate aspect.
Wouldn't it be nice if completely fanless miner existed, so a solo miner but completely passively cooled.
Yeah,
so maybe like a honking piece of honking beautiful piece of copper that just sits on top of the ASIC and does the job, and then the software stack does the job of
regulating.
You know, I mean, it turns out it's quite complex and you're working within a certain window, you cannot go too low anyway, but I was convinced that This is something I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And at that point, actually, I distributed a few Bitaxes through the local Bitcoiner community. I knew that people were kind of resonating with the whole idea of having it, their own little bit of like hash rate and contributing to the network. So I was convinced that I was going to build a fanless Bitcoin solo miner. Thought about the name. Whisper hash sounded
so that's like where your handle comes from.
Yeah.
I was about to ask you that. Okay.
So it sounded like a good brand name, as we're great at naming as nerds, so it sounded good to me. And then I thought I was going to do that. And sort of like next logical transition is I will need a social identity to engage with the community. And
I see.
So I created a Twitter X handle and then from previous interactions with Bitcoiners, I knew about Noster. I was like, okay, Bitcoiners are in Noster. You know,
some of them are. A surprising amount aren't.
It's an interesting topic in itself. You know, why, given the extent, like maybe a side topic, given the extent to which values align, why Bitcoiners,
why are so many Bitcoiners still cocked by Elon and Twitter and X?
We can get into this, but so I created this identity on Noster and just like started posting on my hardware explorations.
I see. So you you documented your journey a little bit and participated in the community in that way.
Yep.
Yeah,
I saw some engagement. But then through that, I could not not just notice start noticing some Noster kind of unique traits.
You got infected by the Noster bug along the way.
Yeah, so it was like, it piqued my curiosity to the point where at some, and it also gave me some ideas. Okay, this is like a pretty unique network. Maybe there's something I can do actually that is more network native. And I had some questions, some basic questions, including, okay, but how, like, what is the state that this thing is at, even in terms of active users and the sats flowing through the economy and so on?
So that's where your data background came back in.
So I went looking for our data, just like Google searches, saw a few things. But I couldn't quite see what I thought was reliable data.
Yeah.
Because I have, you know, this is, what is it called? Professional, occupational hazard, you know?
Yeah,
I see somebody's data product and I pick up on enough smells of like, okay, I don't think I can trust this.
Yeah.
Plus I was seeing wildly varying kind of numbers. And,
the data we have is subpar, for sure. Yeah. I know nothing about data science, but I know that the data we have is basically dog shit most of the time.
So at that point I was like, okay, I'm like, I'm sufficiently intrigued and I'm the data guy. You know, I'll just do this, and this will be also sort of my active learning journey, hands-on.
Nice.
I will understand what's going on better. So I started building very early versions of the data acquisition infrastructure, and also learning about key events. You know, kind one, kind three, and so on, bit by bit. And so my initial push was to, very naive in retrospect, trying to understand active users, daily active users on Noster. So interesting, right?
It should be such an easy thing to figure out, right? Yeah.
So that took me on a scenic journey of Noster and everything that's going on. And sort of very, it didn't take very long where it just dawned on me that this was very special. this was very special, and it was profound.
What makes you say that? Like, what was the insight or the cascade of insights that you have that makes you say that now?
So one is cryptographic identity. Of course, you hold your keys; nobody can.
No one. Yeah, I mean,
no one.
Very apropos to what happened
exactly,
to you, right?
Yeah.
Like,
so
the thing
was,
that happened to you is impossible on Noster.
Easy.
Yeah.
And then next insight, and this is also when I was starting to listen to No Solutions.
How did you discover that? How did you find it? Like, we do zero marketing or anything of that sort.
I think
on purpose, you know, we want people to discover us in some weird way.
I was trying to remember the sequence, and I think the sequence was I think I saw an unrelated interview with Justin Moon.
Mm.
I think he was on TFTC, something like this.
Eventually,
So I was like, okay, this guy is...
He name dropped us a couple times.
He's amazing. I don't think he actually... I don't think he did at that point, or maybe he did. But I went and followed him on Noster. And then I think this was actually between cohorts. Mm. So I was already following you, but it was between cohorts, so you were not publishing No Solutions episode, so I could not see it through that channel. But at some point he mentioned just like a very simple comment he made somewhere that wouldn't be great if somebody just built this thing where you could talk to something along the lines where you could talk to No Solution. Maybe this is my interpretation. Talk to No Solutions and kind of vet your ideas against how the topics were explored.
Against the hive mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was like, interesting, but what is this No Solutions thing? So I went looking for it, and lo and behold, I found it. And I started with episode one. I know they're not episodes, but from the first dialogue. And then I just kept listening.
That's amazing. Awesome.
I kept listening, then...
So you ended up listening to Justin again, you know?
Yeah, twice. at least twice.
Yeah.
And so I listened to a few early ones, then I started complementing it with the ones, with the more recent ones.
Yeah.
With the most recent ones.
Okay. To understand, jumping back and forth. Yeah.
Yeah. So to understand.
That's good.
Okay. Where's the frontier?
Yeah.
And then I kind of like met in the middle somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I covered them all.
And you mentioned to me before that it was quite useful on your journey. So that makes me very, very happy, because that's, of course, the whole point. We are notoriously bad at explaining ourselves and getting the word out there and kind of explaining our way of thinking and kind of what we went through collectively and kind of trying to work on Nostra and so on. And so I'm glad that the one artifact that we have, which is the recorded dialogues, were helpful to at least one person. So that's great. Massive success. So I'm very happy to hear that.
No, I really think it's a crown jewel, honestly.
And where are you now? Where are you now in terms of your journey? Like in terms of, like one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you is because you mentioned to me that Nostra kind of swallowed you whole, and you were at the point where, like, you felt so compelled to look into it and work on it and so on and figure it out that you weren't able to do much else. Yeah. And so that to me is always interesting, because there is very few people that will just say that publicly.
Yeah, correct. And I had about half a dozen other projects, including this, the Bitcoiner miner thing going. After a while, I just realized that everything is just kind of has been pushed to the side. And I was 24/7 more or less with my agent trying to progress.
And how is it now for you? You just went through the first week of your first cohort that you're participating in, and I mean you're way more well versed about this whole thing than most other people, because you listened to No Solutions and so on. You kind of knew what you would get yourself into. But still, how was it for you? How was kind of, what did you expect? What did align with your expectations? Were there some things that surprised you? Did you enjoy it first and foremost? And where are you now, like having gone through the first week and participated in, you know, like the first Tuesday talks, the first Wednesday workshop, first Friday demo day? How was it for you?
Yeah. I think overall, very first week is super intense, and it's also part of this could be me, because I am, you know, my social muscle is not particularly well exercised. It's kind of atrophied, especially after months of just like me and my agents.
That's the tension we're working with, inviting 21 introverts and nerds, like nerdy introverts, the worst kind of introverts, to an island, not letting them leave, and just packing them all into a room working, trying to have them work together 24/7. It's, you know, there's some tension there. Everyone is feeling this, so you're in good company.
Yeah, so I land, and of course, these are remarkable individuals. So it's very high bandwidth communication with every single one of them.
Yeah.
So it's just, that alone is just... taxing, maybe not the right word, but you expend a lot of energy, because
absolutely,
it's like you have to be so switched on.
It's my go-to pro tip for everyone who's new. I think I mentioned this to you as well in the beginning. Plan in lots of alone time and get lots of sleep.
Yeah.
Like you'll need time to decompress. You need time where you're completely alone, and you need sleep first and foremost, because you have just too many inputs. You'll just get too many inputs from too many sites, too many new things, too many ideas. And your subconscious mind will have to do a lot of integrational work and just kind of composting all those kind of things.
Yes.
So at least for me, like alone time and sleep. If I don't get enough alone time and sleep, I just go crazy and start engineering. So.
Yeah, so the social aspect was intense. But then, so first week, I knew the structure roughly, but still, it wasn't quite obvious to me how much time I would actually have to work on the demo. So I was a bit on edge early on in the week, where, you know, I wanted to show something real by Friday. And I know the handbook and the way this is framed, that, wow, Thursday is unstructured time.
Yeah. You have all Thursday to prepare for Friday.
Very, very unstructured. So I was a bit on edge about that. And I think, but everybody is, turns out.
Yeah.
So, I changed my mind as to what I was going to do on Wednesday. Also, as advertised, this
good.
Many people this told good. Me. I was literally pacing on the beach Wednesday evening, just like for 2 hours probably, just like pacing.
Good.
Thinking, okay, this thing that I have in mind, am I actually able to produce something by Friday where I would just not bomb completely, you know?
And bombing completely is also okay.
Yes, totally. Yes, I think...
as you know, only like opting out is not okay. You're not allowed to opt out, and showing slides is not okay. Those are the big no-nos. Bombing is completely okay.
Yeah, I think it's should be encouraged also, because that's kind of a sign that you attempted something, maybe a little too ambitious.
Yeah.
So you kind of, you want some rate of... Not failure, but maybe, okay, the person didn't get there in time.
Yeah,
you know?
No, that, and I mean, that's why we always say, just show something, even if the demo breaks, even if it doesn't work, doesn't matter. Like, it's get the idea across, and if something fails, it really doesn't matter. At least you tried, and at least you tried to demo actual, you know, working product, actual code.
And it's like one remarkable thing, actually, that I observed is that nobody has recorded any video of their stuff working in case they would bomb. So that is an interesting observation. So people were so confident but also comfortable in you know, actually not having something working, you know, on stage.
It's no time to record videos.
And I decided I decided to do the same thing. I was like, okay, this may not work, but I'm just gonna show what I have at that point in time. Yeah. I took a few precautions, kind of like normal software engineering, where I could kind of restore to a working configuration, but not too much.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the spirit. That's good.
But the demos were incredible, and it's also quite varied. Probably two. It's hard to pick favorites, but the variety was there, and kind of some stuff was. I mean, for example, we saw a port of FIPS to another operating system that was just done within a week or within a couple of days.
Yeah.
So not a particularly spectacular demo in the literal sense, you know.
But lots of work has to go into it.
Yeah. Like literally the gentleman was like, Andre was showing a terminal and just like packets going across.
Yeah.
But fucking hell, you know?
Yeah.
All right. This is
so that we're cooking. I mean, like you said, these are all exceptional people that are here, and they actually know how to get stuff done. So that's and demo days are always a testament to that.
Yeah.
And like it's fun to. For me, the most fun is seeing how things come together in terms of some of the building blocks we're using now didn't even exist a year ago, and now it's kind of like second nature to a lot of people. Mm. And this just kind of keeps happening, and it's a positive spiral. It's a reinforcing feedback loop of positivity. Of okay, now we have Blossom, now we have Insights, now we have Naplets, for example, and now we have FIPS, and you can just plug all these things together and build things very easily that were borderline impossible to do before we had these building blocks. And that's just so beautiful to see. And of course, you know, like Nostr, same thing and so on. And you know, on the monetary side, of course, almost nothing we do would be possible without Bitcoin and without eCash and all those underlying things. But they are, of course, a given. They're not second nature, they're first nature. They're like the air we breathe. Mm. And so to me, that's amazing to see the evolution cohort by cohort. And also new people coming in and getting up to speed and really, really getting it quickly. Like getting the various primitives that we have, like it just makes sense to them. And that also to me is a good signal that we're on the right track. Like we're not completely deluding ourselves and just, you know, like hallucinating shit left and right.
Yeah.
So I'm very happy that, you know, like the new people like you that joined this cohort, it seems like everyone got something out of it and stuff more or less makes sense. So that's a good sign. That's a good sign for me.
So it's also it's something to be expected also, in the sense that when you're building stuff, if you pick the right abstractions, you know, and the right primitives,
yeah,
then things compose and
yes,
things layer in the beautiful way that is capable of supporting very tall structures, you know,
yeah,
complex structures, reliably. So we have, at this point, we have some wonderful primitives, I think. Blossom
yeah
is one of them. You know, content undressable, blob storage.
Yeah.
One of them, obviously, right?
Yeah, FIPS on the networking layer.
FIPS. So there's, it's quite clear we're still kind of at the network fabric, infrastructure, and primitives stage.
Yeah.
But you're already seeing some outlier success stories.
Yeah.
For example, one of my favorites is ZapStore.
Yeah.
Now, that thing just needed to exist.
Yeah,
this is
absolutely
such a perfect fit for Nostr.
Yeah.
You're a developer, you publish in an, you know, uncensorable fashion, everything is signed
yeah
with your Nostr identity.
Yeah.
People see who you are through the web of trust.
Yeah.
It's amazing. This just fits so
yeah
perfectly.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
So it's the first and only thing I install on a new phone, and then everything goes from there.
Yeah.
It's like always, I get a new phone, I install ZapStore,
yeah,
I install the apps that I have in my list, and I, you know, like I use my various phones differently, I install some other things. If it's not on ZapStore, I'm not interested, basically.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's I live a very pure life, very simple life. And of course, what makes me insanely happy is ZapStore came out of the first cohort, so
right,
it actually evolved from discussions we had around how would you do an antivirus system using Nostr. Right. Like you have binaries, and you can, you know, like malware scanning, basically. And then I think Francis was working on this idea already, had this idea already, and then we kind of turn it around, and basically if you do the positive of that, then you have an app store. Like those are the apps I trust,
right,
those are the binaries I trust. And then we went to, okay, what if the developers, you trust the developer and the developer signs the release and so on and so
mm-hmm
on. And of course, you know, like, I mean, there's lots of prior work on this. Lots of people still use GitHub release pages,
mm-hmm,
similar idea and so on. And I just love it how it evolved and how well it works. Like It worked from the get-go already. Francis had put a ton of effort into this, and I talked to him. Like there, we recorded, we have a recorded dialogue with Francis.
Yes.
That's how blessed we are.
Yes.
And now it's just, it's a fantastic app store. No matter how you cut it,
absolutely.
Like it's on par basically with the big app stores that everyone uses.
Absolutely.
And it has all the features, and it just fucking works. It
yes
just fucking works. It's
yes
so great.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And there's, I mean, credit to the team, because having listened to the dialogue with him, there's a lot of stuff that they need to grind on continually.
Absolutely.
Right? Version
yeah
mismatches.
It's not an easy task.
And so on.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm very grateful.
And now also publishing,
exists.
I think I mentioned it when I talked to him, but it's worthwhile mentioning it. And I actually myself didn't do it yet, but I plan to do that very, very soon. I haven't built a native app in a very long time. But someone, I think it was American Hodl, and I'm sure some other people as well, you can just instruct your agent, build an Android app and publish it on ZapStore,
yeah,
and it will just work. That's
yeah
how permissionless it is. And then you don't even need an Android phone, you don't need anything. It's just the publication pipeline that's built for ZapStore is so well done.
Yeah.
And pushing an Android app to ZapStore is so easy and so seamless right now. That's just amazing. Like anyone who's ever been fighting with the review process of, you know, doesn't matter if it's iOS or if it's the Google Play Store, like knows how painful this can get. And that's the main benefit of a permissionless world. You actually don't have to ask for permission. You can just push stuff out there and give it to the people that are interested in it.
Yeah, it's also, wonder, it seems like the next natural step is making part of this application app release pipeline seamless in a way where somebody could vibe an app, maybe by talking to their phone, and it would get published to the Zap Store, and maybe in a fashion with everything around it, where that becomes kind of this remixable type of content.
Oh, yeah, know? For sure. Yeah.
And I don't know how much headache it would cause to the Zap Store guys if we suddenly saw an explosion of apps.
Yeah, I mean, that's how every single Linux distribution started, right? Like, you fork something that exists and you give it your own spin and so on. And Pablo actually played around with this idea in the past. He put a little, like, in some of his projects, and I'm not sure where his thinking is now, but a while ago he was like, what if every little app has like a little chat box that lets you chat with an in-app agent that can modify the software that's running? So you can just prompt the feature into existence and just modify some things to your liking. I'm of two minds of that when it comes to that, because to me, an app and the interface of an app and how an app works, it's almost like a shared language. Like Excel is a great example. Everyone knows Excel and how it works and how it looks and feels like and so on. There would be many other ways to do a spreadsheet software, but it all looks the same, and everyone's so used to that it's a skill and it's a shared language. So if everyone would have their own flavor of this, some sort of communication would break down in between people if you need to cooperate with people. Just like I think I talked about this in the past, but there are some genius mathematicians and physicists that came up with their own mathematical notations to describe, you know, what they're working on, and not using the default notation that everyone knows, but they came up with their own because they thought it was better. And then, of course, they can't talk to anyone about their discoveries, and no one can, you know, like, make sense of it. So I don't know. I'm definitely a fan of opinionated software. I love opinionated software. But I'm not sure how the world would look like if the software stack of everyone would be hyper-personalized and I don't know. I think we'll find out. People like Pablo and people like Marty Malmi, they're rebuilding the whole software stack that they're using from the ground up right now. So we'll find out.
But this also touches on how things layer fundamentally, because there's the data formats and protocols, and then there is the user experience.
Yeah.
So maybe what emerges naturally is that in the spreadsheet example, that we would converge on one representation which relates to Nostr, right? We have effectively, you know, we are agreeing on schema for events, but maybe this is a more elaborate format, but just as an example. So we converge on the format that describes any sensible spreadsheet, and then users are able to interact with spreadsheets in a hyper-personalized way.
Yeah.
And maybe this is mediated by the agents that are aware of the underlying format and the protocol.
Yeah.
So maybe this, I don't know, maybe this is one version of the
I think that makes a lot of sense. And that's also, I think it was on Tuesday, I showed this one slide. Justin actually sent it to me, Justin Moon, with kind of the velocity of how fast things evolve, and data formats were at the very bottom, and then protocols and so on. And the top layer was intelligence, which is, you know, all the rage right now, which was just kind of a squiggly line, like a drunken random walk evolving very fast. And so the point was kind of, don't worry too much about what agent you use or your harness or what model or whatever. Worry more about what protocol do you build up on, what does your data structure look like, and so on and so forth. Like, worry more about the primitives, because that is what will provide a solid foundation for whatever you're building, and that also doesn't move very quickly. Like, that's, if you want to have this thing used in 10 years from now, really think about your data format and those kind of things. So I think that's very well said. Like, we might have a Cambrian explosion of like UIs and interfaces and how do you interface with the data, but we might be able to agree on a shared data format and all those kind of things that make collaboration possible. I have one more question for you in regards to, you mentioned you were in Silicon Valley and yeah. now you are in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
So how did this happen, and did this in any way relate to your journey and your decision to step out of your professional fiat life?
No, this is we're talking multiple distinct chapters that extend very far into the past. So Silicon Valley chapter was early on, essentially straight out of uni. I got swept up into the first internet wave, also sometimes known as the dot-com bubble. Yeah. So straight out of uni, I had an opportunity to go work in the Bay Area. At that point, I remember vividly, I had to look at the map. So yeah, I have an option to go to this place. I look at the map, oh, like San Francisco, the Bay.
Let's turn around here, otherwise I'll collapse.
So this is so this is where the Silicon Valley at, the proverbial one. And I was, it was no accident that I went into computer science. So to me, there was just zero question that, okay, I'm just going to go for it.
Yeah.
So I went for it. And this was late 90s. Total change of scene and also interesting point in time. Time flies.
How was it for you in Silicon Valley? Like, did you enjoy your time there? Was it kind of too crazy sometimes? Or how was your experience? I'd be curious.
For me, this was also, you know, my 20s. So it was also a journey of, you know, an inner journey of just kind of understanding a bit more about myself, you know, the kind of person I was, and also understanding firsthand, you know, what America stood for, kind of the internals. So there's the professional component, which I think left an imprint forever in me, which is that I'm just very fluid with software. You know, it's when I look at other people or in other places that are attempting to do software, then I can see kind of, it's like almost like a difference when you look at a professional athlete that is doing things kind of naturally, effortlessly, what it looks like it,
yeah? Yeah.
Versus people that are just kind of doing it in a tortured way. Maybe they try to follow the form without understanding kind of the essence. So later on, I observed a lot of this, including I lived in London actually for like 5 years during a wave where agile development was all the rage, and there were a lot of snake oil salesmen going around kind of ruining teams.
Selling Kanban boards.
Exactly. Kanban boards, pair programming, and so on. So the professional side, I'm quite grateful that I got to... Yeah, I got to
live in the belly of the beast for a while.
Yes, and meet other hardcore people.
Yeah.
It was very interesting. But at the same time, I was kind of becoming aware of the broader world and also the internals of the U.S. This is, 9/11 happened when I was there. And I saw all the consequences.
Yeah.
How they were rolling back on a lot of things that America stood for. And, I was also quite idealistic, I think. The final straw for me was when George W. Bush got reelected. Because, I was in California and so on.
Yeah.
First time he was elected, I thought, oh, okay, this is just like an accident, you know.
Yeah.
But then, when he got reelected, you know, despite everything that everybody has had a chance to observe, that really raised some questions in my head as to how rotten the system was.
Yeah, I see.
So at that point, I was like, okay, I think I'm ready to... I was like more certain that I'm kind of European at heart. And as much as there are many things that I love about the States, including the nature, for instance, and the variety of very distinct and deep communities that they have.
It's a big place.
It's a big place in many ways, on many dimensions.
Yeah.
So I was ready to leave. And I was also feeling confident professionally. Okay, I can take what I have learned and mastered and just land anywhere and do something else. I mean, use this to do something else outside of the area. So at that point, I had a choice of, okay, I can always go back to Europe. So let me just go to Asia first.
Okay. I see. So you accident and you didn't want to take the easiest route out.
I was like, okay, let me go to Asia. Check it out. I can always go back to Europe. So went to China first. And then while I was in mainland China, I discovered Hong Kong. I think I was doing like a visa run or something like this. Just took a flight to Hong Kong and just fell in love with the place instantly. What a beautiful place. Very special place. Anyway, so...
What made you fall in love with it? I get, because it's a mix, it's a melting pot kind of place, right? What aspect of it made you fall in love with it? Because I've never been to Hong Kong. I don't know, like you just mentioned the nature in the US and so on. I guess for Hong Kong, it must be something else a little bit.
So a lot of it, I think, is just resonated with me personally. But some aspects are objective. So it's in a beautiful natural setting overall. It's a very compact place, but not as compact as Singapore, and in a different category altogether. But it's in a beautiful setting. So Hong Kong Island, which is the main island, it's kind of like Madeira. You know, it's an island, and so you have water on all sides. So you always see the horizon, and it's also mountainous. So even though this is as urban as it gets and super dense, you don't have this feeling that you're just like trapped in a jungle.
Okay.
And then because of the density and the space constraints, they are benefiting uniquely from being able to construct a top-notch transportation system.
Okay.
Their metro system, the MTR, it really is the best in the world. You know, I lived in many places. I traveled to many places, including Japan. You know, I'm intimately familiar with the London, you know, with the London system.
The tube
and all the anxiety that causes people. So the Hong Kong MTR system really is a gem. And when you rely on it, it just, it really affects the quality of life. So you're able to do things in a single day that would be impractical in other places. So you can literally do maybe like...
Just the ease of moving around.
Just the ease of moving around. Because it's reliable, it's constructed in a way where you don't need to... It's just a very, very well-designed, very reliable system that you just... Nothing breaks ever. So huge difference. And then, of course, the location in terms of regionally. So Hong Kong is like easy to travel to other places in Asia, and it's super connected to other places in the world.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's a hub for sure. Yeah,
there are downsides, of course. And one of the downsides is that, and one of the one where that I think affects me most directly is that the palette of industries and spaces that you can get into professionally is a different one, radically different.
Yeah.
So there is finance is a big pillar, insurance, property, logistics, very few startups. That part is limiting, and it bothers me, and I'm still reconciling this. And this is also part of the reason why I guess I'm like looking outside of this, at this point, like track where you go into a particular industry or whatever, vertical. I'm like, okay, maybe this is the point where I just pick the thing I really feel passionate about and just
you're
try
ready
to do something in that space that is kind of, it's irrespective of the physical realm.
Yeah, I see.
You know?
And you feel like you're ready to plunge yourself into a new vertical in some sense.
Yeah, I think so, yes.
Okay, interesting. You're not the only one from Hong Kong that is participating in this cohort, by the way. We have three Hong Kongers in this cohort, right?
Yeah. uncoordinated, which is interesting also.
Yeah, so people are discovering Hong Kong for themselves individually and discovering sovereign engineering also in their own way, and are coming. And now there's three people from Hong Kong here. So yeah. G sovereignty is in Hong Kong. And, you know, like, wouldn't you think it? We have a female participant.
Is this the first ever or not?
Yes and no. We had like, if you want to squint, we had like 2.5 female participants, okay. But not really. Okay. They kind of were looped in just because they were around, basically, kind of thing. Mm. This is the first female participant that actually signed up, went through the whole process, everything, and is here and is actually also proper technical. Like, actually.
The momentum is going.
We're getting there. Just full disclosure, we don't discriminate by sex. All we ask is like an NPUB and a repo that contains proof of work. Like, whether it's GitHub or something else, doesn't matter. But just, you know, Git repository and NPUB. And so, I was pleasantly surprised that we have a female participant. And she demoed something nice as well. Fantastic. Yeah. Everything's great. Like, I'm very, very happy.
Likewise, yes.
So, tell me more about your kind of what you're currently exploring from the. And I think we didn't finish the conversation about the Noster data science, kind of how that journey. What did you discover and how did it turn out? Like, you were trying to find out the daily active users of Noster and so on. You published some of this data, right?
Yes.
Like, what did you end up publishing and what are the issues you ran into?
So the issues, of course, that you run into is, like I said, my approach.
There's no global. It's one of the issues.
Yeah, exactly.
Episode one
and through.
There is no global.
This has been mentioned a few times. This should be internalized in a similar fashion as the fact that there is no deleting. You know, there's no confirmation of deletion.
Exactly.
So let's get on with it. I was literally just like acquiring the data and trying to construct for my own purpose the usual DAU, MAU, you know, daily active users, monthly active users, and through various events and just like plotting. Okay, these are the unique NPUBs that publish an event, and let me just plot this and see what this looks like. And they arrive at the main metric, you know, the DAU, given activity, you know, unique NPUBs for various events on that date. And of course, what I was seeing is all kinds of crazy shit, massive spikes, and so it was very clear that that deserved a, you know, second look, and that I just, yeah, there was, it like very quickly takes you to like the notion of web of trust.
Yeah,
you have to. So I had to learn that myself.
You saw some of the attacks that we had to go through.
My first instinct was, okay, I just want to get to the fucking DAU. So let me try to construct a block list of NPUBs that are polluting my amazing data set. So my method was quite simple. I was just literally, I would pick a spike on the graph I was seeing, and I would ask the bot, hey, like, there's like something going on here, can you just look into the anomaly? And it does surprisingly well at picking the patterns and constructing the block lists and so on. So for a while I was like cruising like this, but then I got to the point where I satisfied my own curiosity as to at least the order of magnitude that the MAU DAU was at for the network as a whole.
Tell me the number.
It's small. It's moderate. I wouldn't call it small. It's moderate, but
I have a number in mind, but just based on pure vibes. So I'd be curious what the data says.
It's stable. I haven't looked at this in a while. I think it's like something on the order of 20,000-30,000 daily active users.
Yeah.
But
20 is my gut feeling.
Yeah. So I'm actually one of the reasons I decided not to pursue this MAU DAU thing in the end. was that maybe this is actually not going to have a positive effect if people knew ahead of time that, okay, the network is relatively small. So they need to fall in love with it for other reasons than there being a massive user base.
Yeah.
So, and I have since arrived, or I still have a question in my mind, that the thing I was showing, you know, Nostrology, nostrology.gui, one of the domains that I looked at from the data perspective was not Zaps.
Yeah.
Trying to understand, okay, what's the Zaps flow, how many active users there are, and it's small.
Yeah.
It's very small. It's small to the point where it got me thinking, okay, so I can, even though the data is out there, right, anybody can acquire it and cut the data, arrive at the numbers, but even the act of me publicizing this data, you know, is it going to be useful to the people that are working with this, or is it going to do more damage in the sense that, okay, this is so fucking tiny, we're just going to ignore it, you know? So it's still a question in my mind. I think maybe there's a way to expose it in a way where people working on it benefit, so that they can see their MAU, DAU metrics moving.
So I think from a builder's perspective, it's positive in the sense that, you know, and that's what I tell people at Summer in Engineering always as well, just push your stuff out there. It's literally like half the power users of Nostr are in this room. Like, at most, you'll offend like 30 people. You know, don't worry. Just do your thing. Push your stuff out. Don't overthink it. You're not gonna. Okay. Even if it goes viral in a bad way, it's still, you know, like it's such a small
in group. It's live. People. I just don't expose it like on. It's buried a little bit. Okay, but it's live.
Great name, by the way, Nostrology.
Yeah.
Great name.
So, I had this running locally for the longest time, and few weeks before the cohort, I set the goal to actually stand this up as a proper environment, have all the data infrastructure, you know, data processing, all the jobs, and the publishing of the charts happening reliably on a schedule. So this is live now. I have a look, kind of a few domains that I'm publishing data on, which is, one is the relays. I had a look, okay. I mean, it's a foundational piece of infrastructure. I was curious, you know.
Yeah.
What's going on? Then relays, and I have some metrics around Lightning. And then, of course, my darling, Zap Store.
Yeah.
I was interested. What are the trends? You know, total number of apps, breakdown by Nostr native apps, which is, you know, a developer publishing using their own Nostr identity versus what is being republished.
And signed by Zap Store. Yeah,
from GitHub or F-Droid. And then other metrics like, you know, Zaps that are attributable to an app and other aggregations. So this, I think this is kind of the most baked thing that I have working. But then this connects to what I wanted to do, actually, while I'm here. This got me thinking, you know, I've done all this work to acquire the data from the network, figure it out, and the process it in a way where I now have an artifact, you know, in the form of a chart that I can plot. For example, a simple chart where I show a bar chart where I'm showing a count of zaps on per day, and overlaid with a cumulative amount of sats that are attributable to Zap Store apps over time. And then, so I've done all that, but what occurred to me then was that it's kind of there are two problems. One problem is that I had to essentially make an editorial decision, a subjective one, or decision that was aligned with the quote-unquote data story I was trying to tell.
You know, how to slice up the data.
Yeah, how to slice it up, and, you know, what am I trying to, what is the message, right? So that's a decision I had to make that is divorced from the underlying data. And the second thing that bothered me was that again, even though I've done all this work and I have this data now, it's gonna die here, you know? Like, nobody else in the ecosystem is able to benefit from this other than maybe copy-pasting the chart, final chart.
Yeah.
So that got me thinking, okay, maybe there's a way to expose this.
Yeah, set the data free.
Set the data free and make it available for other participants in the ecosystem in the form where it's a primitive that is done kind of in a Nostr native way.
Yeah, but so, at the same time done in a way so that it's easily ingestible by data manipulation tools.
Yeah, exactly.
That a data scientist would use.
Yeah, going back to... Yeah, you want to stand kind of on the shoulders of, again, this layered cake, right? You have the formats at the bottom. So one of the decisions is like, how do you expose, in what format do you expose the data? So I picked Parquet, which is lingua franca of a big data world.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to expose a data set that is terabytes in size and you want to run a crazy aggregation on one column, this is the format.
You know,
it's incredible. Like, lots of serious dudes, mostly dudes, have done a lot of work just on the freaking format.
Sure, sure, sure. And it's a hard thing to do. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's optimized to the point where, which, I mean, it's incredible the lengths to which people go to when they're singularly focused on something. So Parquet is optimized to the point where it actually takes into consideration the speculative execution on the CPU. Mm. So it's able to optimize that level.
It does its own branch protection.
Yeah. So it's incredible. Anyway, so I picked Parquet format and I landed on, the design I landed on was I would be publishing a data manifest event of sorts that would, of course, it's a Nostr event, which means the manifest is signed with the publisher, you know, with the data producer's identity, and the data would be, these Parquet blobs would be exposed via Blossom.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is where I'm at. Basically, data in a Bedrock format that is signed by data producer's identity, that is exposed in a Nostr native way. That is, you know, in a fashion where somebody can
provide your own lens on the data.
Somebody downstream can take it and do something with it that the original data producer did not intend.
And this is slice it up in your own way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are some. There are some aspects that to this that are interesting and deep and need to be unpacked. For example, the question of data provenance, you know.
Yeah.
I have taken these Nostr events from somewhere at a point in time and so on. So how do you capture this? So this is like, I need to think through this. And then maybe also the question of data lineage, it's called. So essentially, you know, I am producing and publishing a data set.
Yeah.
But
where did it come from? How did it evolve over time?
Yeah, exactly. So this data set.
What's the history?
It's what was upstream of data set? You know, it's you can think of this data as a direct cyclic graph. You know, a DAG.
Yeah.
So each data output has inputs and kind of a transformation.
You know, what entity produced the data?
What happened to it? So I think this is also worth thinking through, because like in the spirit of Nostr, I am producing and publishing this data artifact. You know, it's signed with my key, but it's still kind of, it's signed with my key, but it's sort of, you know, trust me, bro, this is loosely what I did with the data, maybe loosely where I got the data. So I think maybe, depending on the response I get, maybe it's worth pushing further in terms of the data lineage. Okay.
I see.
This data set was produced with this exact transform from these upstream data sets, and maybe you publish the whole chain.
Yeah.
In which case, you ultimately actually, if you push in that direction, you have to publish the kind of the raw events ultimately. You know, these are the ZapStore events that I collected. And then there are some interesting questions actually. you know, is that a good thing or not? Because this gets into a question of bit rot, you know.
Mm.
Some bit rot is good, but some, when you talk about kind of structured data that you want to take downstream into applications, bit rot not so good.
Yeah.
You want to you want to have the whole chain, you know?
Yeah. What makes you say that some bit rot is good? When is bit rot good?
I think social data bit rot is good, you know.
In the sense of just like forgetting?
Yeah. Yeah. So for instance, yeah, I'm not sure if I want to draw it. I mean, it's obvious, but sometimes you question whether you should draw attention to it or not. But the history of your follows, somebody can capture this. You know, if I stand up, some party stands up a data acquisition infrastructure and just captures every mutation of the kind 3 event, they have the whole history, you know?
Yeah.
So it's things like this, I think, maybe borderline, where it's worth pausing at least for a moment. Okay, is this a good thing? Like publishing some data, even though it's out there, but when you get like all the way upstream, this is maybe this kind of event, because with what I'm proposing, you know, it's data is these are large data sets that are in a format that makes it possible to ingest and process just enormous amounts of data.
So yeah.
To the extent that somebody is able to acquire data from a representative slice of the network or as much data as they're able to grab,
yeah,
somebody would be able to run some computation on it and get to something they're looking
at. Yeah, make inferences based on it.
Yeah. So there's that question. I think eventually it brushes up against this. But I think this is, I'm hopeful that it's, this doesn't surface in every domain. For example, I mentioned the Zap Store is one of the domains. It's kind of like, it's a very specific domain. And data, you know, they're not capturing application usage data. It's not available anywhere that, you know, Gigi has these apps installed and he's using them on this cadence, whatever.
Yeah.
That data is not available. But the app catalog is available, releases and so on.
Yeah.
So I think it's okay for that data to go like all the way upstream to all the events that were collected at some point.
I see. Okay. Yeah. No, I think all that's very interesting. And we had some, after your demo, we had some good discussions about like why are Nostr events structured in the way they are? What are some pitfalls that you might run into? And you also mentioned like exposing these data sets on Blossom servers, and I think you yourself made this comment. Maybe you want to look into ContextVM and exposing it in a different way as well. So there is a lot of prior work that has been done by Jesus and also by Pete Wynn. And it's inspired by No Solutions. There is the good stuff. It's also recorded dialogues, great, great format. And they talk a lot about kind of how, if you have a server that serves certain data, how do you expose it over Nostr without sending all the events over Nostr, basically, like without getting all the data out from the database onto relays. And that's, you know, like, again, that's where ContextVM is also relevant and so on. And you can make these bridges, make kind of Nostr native bridges without porting everything to Nostr, like directly, so to speak. And I think it's, you know, like you have to figure out what's the right tool for the job and kind of, you know, what trade-offs are you okay with and what also is actually workable in practice, because the things you mentioned with, if you have data sets that are like terabytes and terabytes in size, then you have to think about this stuff differently than it's just, you know, a couple of kilobytes that you send around and that can be everywhere and so on.
Yeah.
Like globally replicating terabytes and terabytes of data sets is not an easy task. Maybe not even I'm not sure if I want to host terabytes and terabytes of data I don't care about on my Boston service.
This is another aspect to unpack at some point, which is, okay, so maybe you make the data available as Blossom blobs, but maybe you're not constraining yourself to only to this method of distribution.
Yeah.
Maybe you some data you distribute through.
Maybe you don't care what
storage, you know,
what the storage provider is, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
So maybe the right interface would be one abstraction layer.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's above or below, but whether it's stored on the Blossom or as a torrent, or we mentioned Marty Malmy's hash tree as well, which I think would work well for your use case. Almost shouldn't matter, you know, and I think that's also historically what stuff gravitated to, where you have a storage provider, and in the background, whether it's like S3 or like whatever else, it doesn't matter. And it's interesting. It's an interesting problem space.
There are many directions. So I'm kind of at the stage where there are many directions that I can push this into.
Yeah.
And I feel quite confident that I would get there. Next step along every dimension so far, but what I'm trying to validate this instead. I'm trying to validate this end to end. So just light this up, kind of a tracer,
yeah,
a tracer bullet cell. Okay, find somebody who is interested and enough, who has a burning need to actually consume some data that somebody may be producing through this method. So. I think once you actually light things up end to end, you flesh out. It just becomes clear. It becomes less theoretical and more concrete. Yeah. The concerns come into focus that you may not have.
No, that's always a good approach.
Visited.
Get real user. Yeah. Get at least one real user, even if it's yourself. In the best case, get multiple users that are actually real, actually using your stuff, that have real needs. And serve those needs and then iterate from there. So I think it's a good approach. What were some things on Friday that you liked? You mentioned one already, but we saw 21 demos. So, which is awesome that we managed to land on 21, by the way, just kind of as a side note, that's the number we're aiming for. Yeah. We managed this time. So we saw 21 demos. What's some of the things that stood out to you?
Again, difficult to pick, but
you mentioned you don't want to pick favorites, but I'm not asking you for favorites, just kind of what is something that resonated.
I think the globe, the FIPS globe, I think it was Thomas demoed this.
Yeah,
this was very well done, and also I mean it showed the extent to
it was
which
very
the
impressive
FIPS network has propagated. So that was good. I was also, what I liked was that some folks use the opportunity to just like play with things, play around, just have a little fun.
Yeah.
So we had a demo by the FLX, Felix.
Felix, yeah.
The 600 billions gentleman. he had the, I don't know, the NFTs, like
trading cards.
Trading cards. And it was done beautifully, tastefully. And it's like a lighthearted project, but obviously a lot of work went into this. And it's, it's good to mix things up like this. So not everything is serious. Some things are through play. And this is actually maybe one way that you stumble on something.
Absolutely. Yeah.
G also showed something similar. Nostragotchi's, I don't remember the name. But that was compelling. I was really impressed by what the Archipelago guys are doing.
Yeah, it is a very impressive project. It's very far along. Yeah, it's very very polished already. Yeah.
Yeah, but overall, it's I think it's just very clear that we have. We have a lot of capability and creativity and diversity packed into a cohort. So this is to your earlier question, you know, did it kind of, is it the way I imagined it? And it's and it very much is. You know, it was something that came through the previous dialogues on No Solutions. Was just kind of the caliber and the level of agency of the people
yeah.
that are part of the group.
Yeah.
So I am...
It turns out that you actually really can just do things.
Yeah.
You so can't just build stuff.
I am very grateful that the stars aligned, that I could be here, you know, as part of this group, you know, in this place, in this particular moment in time.
Awesome, awesome, yeah. I mean, I'm very glad it worked out. I'm very glad you managed to make the trip. I'm very glad you're here. And I can just echo what you said, you know, like, I think it's an amazing group of people again. And in terms of being too early to tell, usually what happens is, like you said, lots of ideas, lots of stimuli in the beginning, and then the dust settles a little bit in week two and week three. And usually what happens is some idea or some combination of ideas catches fire, and after the dust has settled, like the real building starts. So usually after end of week two, beginning of week three, really interesting things usually tend to emerge. Because it's always like everything is a remix, right?
Right.
And you take parts of one project or one idea and marry it with the thing you always had in your head, and then something new pops up. So that's usually how it works.
Yeah. And also, I knew, you know, I was trying to go as fast as I can, given my interest, and just kind of moving at the limit of just the amount of time that's available to try to fill the gaps that I have in my master knowledge. Because the frontier, there are many things at the frontier, and the frontier changes quite quickly. So there were a few things, like FIPS, for example. I knew this is profound, and this has momentum and excitement, and it's, you know, it's very clear that this needs to exist and so on. But I also knew that I have other gaps that I need to fill ahead of this. I wanted to prepare. And I also knew, you know, this would be a big theme here.
Yeah.
Jonathan would be here. Others are here. So this is my chance to actually immerse myself in an area I haven't had a chance to touch yet.
So yeah.
I will try to be mindful of how I balance my time. So even though it seems like 6 weeks is a good chunk of time, but I'll try to balance things in a way where it's not just the stuff that I came here with, you know, in my head already, kind of preconceived, or kind of the itch, the pre-existing itch, but also the things that I haven't touched yet, that I'm exposed to here. So I'll try to balance this.
Yeah, no, I like how you're approaching it, you know, with some thought and some planning, some strategy. Because, yeah, I mean, 6 weeks, it's a lot to commit to. But once you're actually here, the time goes by really fast. And one of the, always at the end of every cohort, we ask people kind of for feedback and what would they do different, like, you know, what was good, what was bad, and so on. And consistently we get, it was too short. And it doesn't matter how long we make it, you know, like the first course were like 8 weeks and we still got like, it was too short. But, you know, like we can't do constant cohorts all the time. So what we landed on now with 6 weeks is, I think, pretty perfect. And it also has to end, you know, like you mentioned the intensity and so on. You can't stomach it for a prolonged amount of time. You need the decompression time. You need the alone time. Everyone needs to go back into their bunker, you know, and just have some solitude and again, like, compost all the thoughts and the inputs and so on, and also regenerate in some sense. And then you can start again fresh. Like, you can't be in full on cohort mode all the time. It would destroy you.
Yeah, you need a pause where a restorative pause where you get to the point where it doesn't feel like you're pushing uphill.
Yeah.
But you again start feeling the pull.
Yeah.
Okay, I just, this thing absolutely is pulling. I'm just like, I'm just gonna like, I'm just gonna see what's going on here.
Yeah. No, you need these, again, just like in nature, you need these cycles. You know, there is a winter exists for a reason and so on. And then spring comes again. And you know, let winter be winter, let spring be spring. Those kind of things. Give me just 1 second. I'll need some water. I'm on the, I'm at my limit when it comes to hydration. But I'm glad that I can be outside and walking and so on. Like, hooray for modern medicine. Hooray for painkillers. Yeah, fantastic. No, like, I'm glad that stuff makes sense to you. I'm always worried about, because there is definitely an iterative in-group dynamic in sovereign engineering. And that's also one thing that actually surprises me and keeps surprising me. People keep coming back. Let's just switch places again because of the mics. And because when we started, I was like, that's such a crazy idea and it's so strenuous and taxing and kind of out there. And there's like basically no payoff except work with cool people, build cool shit, you know, like everyone loses money on sovereign engineering. That's just how it's set up to be. And still people come back. Like we have many repeat participants with people like Jesus who participated in every cohort so far. And that also tells me that there is a need for such a program. Like you mentioned, the high bandwidth interaction with like high quality people. And just hashing things out together and having, lots of dialogos around those problems we're trying to solve. And yeah, I'm just glad it's working. And I'm glad that we are, you know, like people like you are discovering it, bumping into it, and actually making the plunge to participate. So yeah, thank you for that. That's fantastic.
No, thank you. Yeah, I feel very grateful that this all comes together and that this exists to begin with, that this is not to be
that's why I'm doing it. It needs to exist, it
for
needs
granted
to exist.
And it's things don't crystallize by accident, and it's it's specific individuals also.
So if any OG whales are listening, we're looking for sponsors, we're looking for, you know, large-scale philanthropists to sponsor sovereign engineering so it can continue to exist. We want to make patronage great again. All the great artworks in the past were made possible by patrons. So, we want to continue with the program for as long as we can and hopefully also build it out in some way, shape, or form. We discussed this briefly, that Madeira is fantastic. I love doing the cohorts here because it's just so conducive to everything we want to do. Just like, you know, like the walk we just took along the coastline, it's very beautiful. It's very kind of, it gets you in a different frame of mind and so on. You're not sitting in a room drawing on whiteboards and so on. Mm. And we've been thinking about kind of branching out potentially geographically as well. You mentioned Hong Kong, or you mentioned also mainland China, going to like a hardware heavy place, somewhere where you can just, you know, like send a file to whatever, you know, a fab or something, and you have like an integrated circuit like 3 days later.
No joke. That's, no, same day. You can get things same day.
Same day. The European mind cannot comprehend. So, so that would be fun too.
And you will actually, this is like maybe one thing to touch on. There's a lot of vilification that goes on, especially kind of in the States. They're obviously dialing things up, kind of turning the level of heat up against China.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm based in that part of the world, and I have direct experience with people, including people from the mainland.
Yeah.
Including as, you know, I get to meet the nerds and I see how people work.
Yeah.
And it's, there's a lot of hardworking people along many dimensions.
Yeah.
And,
so not everyone is a villain just because they're Chinese.
No. So I think this is kind of, it's a, that's a trap, clearly.
Unfortunately the propaganda is still working to some degree, but I feel like the propaganda machinery is also breaking down to some degree, like one side effect of the internet and social media is like the hyper-fragmentation of everything and so on. I mean, it's different forms of propaganda now, but it's, you know, like, I don't know. I feel like people that are internet native and grew up on the internet and so on, they understand that the regular people are just regular people. Doesn't matter where they come from, you know. Like, it doesn't matter if you're Russian or China or from the US or whatever. It's all just people. Like, just by playing computer games, you'll know that it's all just the same kind of people. Government structures might be different and you know, economic situations might be different and so on. But people are people, usually.
Yeah, once you
And
are,
most people are good. Like, that's otherwise the world wouldn't work.
Yeah, once you have a direct experience of individuals, you know, specific individuals in the group that may be otherwise rolled up to you through media or whatever.
Yeah.
This, it just, that shatters the image very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. All right, I'm all out of steam. Any last words from your side? Anything you want to touch on? Any wisdom you maybe want to pass on to the younglings that aren't listening?
I think this is a bit circular, but no solutions. Do the homework. Every single episode, I would highly recommend. This is... I don't know of a better way to immerse yourself and try to understand the inherent tension, you know, the trade-offs that are involved. I think this is, otherwise, it's much easier to fall into traps, kind of common traps that are based on sort of pre-existing conceptions of how things work on the internet. And then Yeah, I would like to just encourage people to, if they're on the fence, just fucking go for it, you know. I had a very distinct decision fork at some point. You know, I spent several months being immersed in Noster stuff, hands-on, on my own, and I had a choice to make. You know, do I just continue in that mode, or do I just go all the way? And I chose to go all the way, and... arrange everything in the universe around me to be able to be here now. And I'm thoroughly enjoying this. And this is just the beginning.
Awesome. Awesome. Yes. I love it. I want to echo that. Always go all the way. You have nothing to lose. We're all going to die anyway. Might as well go all the way. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was a great joy. And now, same dance as always. Let's hope the recording and everything worked, because I hate nothing more than having to manually recover stuff.
This is the part that makes my heart sink every time I'm listening to it.
That looks good.
For a fraction of a second, it's like, oh my god, did they record this? But then it's, of course, it's like, okay, but I'm listening to it. But
we have backups. But this, like, we have backups.
Momentary.
We have backups. No recording was ever lost. It's just about manual labor, and I want to minimize manual labor. So the clankers will do the rest. All right.
Awesome.